Accession number 8737, rule number 2.
Captain Griffiths, Reel 2. Did you get much in the way of news about the result of the missions that you undertook?
Yes, we used to hear via London and headquarters Cairo from the individuals that we dropped, saying that the drop was successful, and to even say thank you very much for looking after us so well. The strange occasion did happen once when I was happened to be in a pub in London called the Roundhouse in Covent Garden. This was getting towards the end of the war, when an individual in army uniform walked into this pub. He was a New Zealander and said, I recognize you. And it transpired in actual fact that we had dropped him on an operation in Greece to blow up a viaduct, and that he had since come out of Greece and had dropped again in the south of France to help the Mackie. Those were certainly the two means whereby, well, the last one, of course, was very unusual, I think. It was an amazing coincidence, I think.
The viaduct was the Gorgopotamus.
That's the one, yes, yes.
Now, you said that the people whom you dropped were known only by pseudonyms to you.
Yes.
But did you ever discover the names of any important people, their actual names afterwards?
Not as far as the Yugoslavs were concerned. On this drop in Greece, we did in actual fact find out that certainly two of the names were the leader of the expedition, a Brigadier Myers, and the number two, which was kept, Major Woodhouse.
How long would it take you to reach Greece or Yugoslavia?
The journeys there and back were roughly in the 9, 10 or 11 hour endurance, so to get there would be roughly what, a 4, 4.5, 5 hour journey.
Travelling at what kind of speed?
I suppose about 200 knots.
And the height?
Height about between 15 and 17,000.
And when you got there, can you describe again what you were looking for?
Yes, we always dropped both agents and supplies on a pattern of light, a pattern which was known to us and given to us from the partisans through London to the Cairo headquarters.
What did the pattern of lights look like?
It could be a cross, a large cross. It could be a square. It could be a diamond. It could be any of those shapes, really. It was necessary to have these shapes because one did come across small villages that would probably, the lights there would give an indication of probably a dropping zone. So it was necessary to have a pattern of lights on which we should drop them.
How difficult was it to find the pattern of lights?
It was really a very highly skilled operation in many ways, and I really admired the navigators on these trips. They were extremely well qualified navigators. They would operate on probably 3 or 4 different methods of navigation. They would, of course, do the normal dead reckoning, but they would also home by radio on probably a known radio station if they knew that Belgrade was broadcasting, and it would be probably broadcasting up to roughly midnight every night. We would home by radio onto those stations. They'd also use astro navigation, and of course using the navigation of known coded lights from, say, the Turkish coast.
Did you ever get completely lost?
No, never.
Were there any cases that you heard of planes having accidents in the land in the dropping zone?
No, not up until the time not for the whole time I was with the force. We lost a Wellington on a Crete raid. We were dropping supplies to some British Army people that had been left in Crete and were operating as saboteurs on the Crete island. We were scheduled to drop some supplies there, and for this raid we used a Wellington, and halfway there its engines failed and it had to ditch. The pilot and the navigator were picked up, and the wireless operator, but we lost the rear gunner. He unfortunately went down with the aircraft. They were subsequently sighted by a South African squadron, which was based at Mariut, and were rescued by a Navy rescue launch. That was the only fatality that we had during the time I was with the flight.
Do you remember when that was, approximately?
On October the 6th, 1942.
Now, I think that you took part in the famous raid against the Italian fleet at Taranto. Can you tell me, in as much detail as you can recollect, your memory of that raid?
Yes. When you mentioned the raid on Taranto, I think that it could be separated probably into two parts, because I think the Fleet Air Arm carried out a daylight raid on the Italian fleet at Taranto. We did a night operation on it. It was necessary in the Battle of the Mediterranean to get the Italian fleet out of Taranto. It was causing a threat which the Royal Navy wanted to be able to deal with. And so it was decided that in addition to what the Fleet Air Arm doing the daylight raids, that the RAF would do a night raid. And the only aircraft that would reach Taranto at that time, of course, was the Liberators in the Middle East. So it was decided that on the 9th of June, that I think it was three Liberators would carry out this night raid on Taranto.
Which year was this?
In the 9th of June, 1942.
Can you describe what you saw?
It was a beautiful night, and a clear night, and the visibility for that time of the year was very good. The flak from the ships in the harbour was very heavy when you arrived there, but not particularly accurate. It was a lot of anti-aircraft was being pushed up into the air, but it wasn't, in our opinion, very accurate. So it didn't really deter us from doing a good bombing run on the ships in the harbour.
Did you have much of a sight of the ships?
Not really. It was sufficient to be able to see reasonably clearly the harbour and not the ships themselves, but certainly the outline of the harbour and the coastline.
Could you see the result of your own bombing?
Not really, no. No. We felt that in actual fact we had dropped our bombs in the harbour. But whether we didn't see any results of any ships being hit or anything like that.
What about losses on the raid?
Big one.
What about losses on the raid?
Oh, none. The only loss we ever sustained in the flight during my time was the Wellington on Crete.
I think you also were present at the German bombing of Coventry.
Oh, yes.
Could
yes.
you say something about that and how you came to be there?
Yes, indeed. It was. I was at that time based at Bramcote, which was an airfield just outside Coventry, and my job was teaching the Poles to fly on the Wellington aircraft. It was really an operational conversion unit, converting them to fly the Wellington. And on the particular night of the big raid, I was night flying on local circuits and landings with a Polish pilot when this raid suddenly started, and the lights of the airfield went out, and I was instructed to remain airborne during the height of this bombing. And I did, in actual fact, encircle Coventry and saw the actual raid from the air.
What did it look like?
It looked fairly devastating. It was certainly a lot of fires burning, and of course that was the only thing that we could see, was the burning of the buildings during the time of the raid.
Did you see much anti-aircraft defence?
No, I didn't. Probably the anti-aircraft defences would have been probably further out. I didn't see any, no. The main defence at that time, I think, was the balloons surrounding the Coventry, which were intended either to prevent the Germans coming in or making them fly much higher and probably make their aiming less accurate. But I didn't see any anti-aircraft fire, no.
Did you see the actual German planes taking part in the raid?
No, I didn't. No, I was much lower than that. I was going around at... which, of course, was safer for me to do so, was to fly around at a much lower altitude.
Now, going back to the period when you were conducting bombing operations against German-occupied Europe, I think there was one significant occasion when the fuel ran out. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I can. It was probably one of the most horrifying experiences of the war, as far as I was concerned. It occurred on November the 7th, 1941, when a large raid was planned for Berlin and an alternative target of Mannheim. The weather report that was given prior to the operation was very poor, so much so that it was considered that we probably wouldn't get back to our base and that we might have to land at diversionary airfields in the south of England. There were two targets which were probably at the extreme of the Wellington that I was flying at that time, and together with a high bomb load was on the verge of only just being able to do it had the weather been really good. On this particular night, the weather was atrocious. It was far worse, in fact, that what was given to us when we at the briefing. We couldn't get above the cloud level because it was far too high, higher than the aircraft could go. So we were flying practically the whole of the way in solid cloud, and a cloud which had high icing, which meant that the operational capability of the aircraft was even reduced further than what it normally would have been. We got to Mannheim on a dead reckoning, which was the only way that we could navigate, and so we dropped our bombs on a dead reckoning time. Now, unbeknown to us, because we couldn't get any landmark from the because of the cloud, we'd overshot Mannheim, and because there was very high winds on the return journey, we were battling very hard against the elements. It was unfortunate also that on that particular raid I got a navigator who had not carried out any operational trips before, and although that he was a very good navigator, he didn't really have the courage of his conviction, And when we were had flown to what we had thought was a time when we should have been hitting the English coast, we were just nowhere near it, or we just couldn't see any indication that we were near the English coast. And petrol at that time was getting very short, to a degree that I felt that I had to send out a Mayday call. And so I operated a Mayday call, and fortunately received a reply from Stratis Hall, which was, I think, in Suffolk, based in Suffolk. And they homed me on to Stratis Hall, and I asked for an emergency landing, and they allowed me to fly straight in. And as I landed, both the engines cut out, so I just really managed to land back at the nick of time.
And it was a successful landing?
Oh, yes. Yes. Hmm?
I think that we should say that a number of the statistics you've been able to give in the course of this interview have been obtained from your logbook, and so are pretty reliable, such as dates.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's still no doubt about the authenticity of the dates at all.
You mentioned training Polish airmen. Was there much difference between Polish airmen and the RAF, or were they rather similar?
Yes, there was one big difference, and that they didn't speak the language, and consequently that teaching Poles to fly was almost as dangerous as going on operations. It was a big barrier, and I felt that doing that for some length of time, I put years on me.
What type of accidents did you nearly have?
Well, I did in actual fact have one accident teaching them, but the accidents that I nearly had was that because of language problems, we were coming in to land one day, and the pilot had forgotten to alter the pitch of the air screws from coarse pitch to fine pitch for landing. And I was shouting to him, you know, pitch, pitch, to remind him to change the pitch of the air screw, and he switched off his switches, which didn't cut the engine out, because I was able to put the switch back on before the engine, in actual fact, had stopped turning. But it was a slight problem that we came up against. The time when I really had one accident was when on landing, we didn't have runways, of course, in those days. It was just a plain grass airfield. And I was sitting on the right-hand side of the cockpit, and the Polish pilot was on the left. I couldn't see what was happening on the left-hand side. And, of course, another aircraft had landed on the left and came into us from the left-hand side just after we landed. We were on the ground, so we collided on the ground.
Did you have much contact with the American Air Force?
Yes, there was one occasion when we were at Fayed. A detachment of the U.S. Army Air Corps arrived at Fayed with the specific object of carrying out a raid on the Ploiești oil fields at in Romania. We helped with the briefing of this force, because it was called the Halvorsen Detachment, by the way. We were helped in the briefing of this this force. Excuse me. And we also took the debriefing team to Habaneer in Iraq to meet them coming back. It was not really a very successful raid. The force really wasn't well up on the type of operations to be carried out in that part of the world. They had been used to very sophisticated forms of navigation, where they'd had radio stations and various navigation aids, which of course were denied them on this particular raid. And very few of them actually got through to Ploesti to bomb the oil wells, and they came back to Habonaire in a slightly bedraggled state, some of them having been lost and some of them having probably never been to the actual oil fields themselves. As a consequence, it was decided that they would require the help, possibly, of the Royal Air Force in able to accustom them to the type of operations in the North African theatre. So it was planned that some daylight raids would be carried out on Benghazi using the RAF as the leaders in this particular raid. And it occurred on two occasions, on the 8th of July 1942 and the 13th of July 1942.
Were you on these raids?
Yes, I was on both of them.
Can you describe them from your own personal experience?
Yes, it was the only, I think, the second time that I'd carried out any daylight operations. As you know, the RAF usually operated at night. So in some ways, it was something exciting to look forward to. But on the other hand, one always thought that it was an area which the RAF really weren't, certainly from the heavy bomber point of view, too familiar with. And also that there was certain apprehension, because I don't think the Liberator had ever had a baptism to fire, and we didn't really know quite how the aircraft would react if it was badly hit. As it happened, although the area was reasonably well defended, and there was quite heavy flak, and reasonably accurate, but I can't remember any casualties. There's certainly no casualties from the RAF point of view, but I can't remember at this stage whether there were any casualties to the Americans. But they were considered two successful operations.